Okay, now I get the honor of introducing this gentleman. I first met him in 1984 when I interviewed him for the late lamented Melody Maker in the UK. I was their American correspondent. At the time, he was the singer and guitarist in the Long Riders, the first truly alternative country rock band. For, I guess, on nearly 20 years now, you've been the founding leader of the Cole Porters, who are playing tonight at the Station Inn at 10 p.m. Be there. Aloha. He is also a fantastic author. He did the first ever Graham Parsons biography, and he's got two Dylan books, including the recent Shelter from the Storm, Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Years, Hold It Up, from Jawbone Press. Born in Kentucky, a rocker in L.A., resident in Britain for many years, but he is a true American in everything he sings and plays, Sid Griffin.
Thank you, David. That's very kind.
Well earned. You are, as you point out in the bio on your website, an eighth-generation Kentuckian.
Yeah,
what did the what did the first seven do?
I don't know the first seven. I know the first one had the immortal name Greenberry Griffin, which is the middle name of my son. Noah Greenberry Griffin, which I know people think is probably a hideous name to be named Greenberry anything, but the first one came over, he was thrown out of Scotland, and I think at Bannett Point after Culloden. So he was a school teacher, and they paid him £5, and I say £5 because it wasn't the United States of America yet.
How do you get thrown out of Scotland?
Well,
you know, that's they had the Highland clearances.
Yeah, they had the Highland clearances, and I think he was they were asked to leave. I think he was a Jacobite, and he worked for £5 a year, and you got one free meal from one of the parents of one of the students you taught a week. And you also got paid in, I think, bushels of corn and all that. And the reason we know this is my father and I bizarrely found the actual piece of paper that was his school contract. Isn't that weird?
Wow.
To have a piece of paper from 1769 or whatever it was. Pops found it through doing research down at the Filson Club, which is the Kentucky Historical Society. Yeah. And we actually have the piece of paper, got it copied, and it's preserved now and all that. I don't think there was a lot of musicians till my grandmother was a musician. My mother's mother.
Professional or amateur?
She could have been professional. She played in the Louisville Orchestra and was just a terrific, terrific fiddler. And or she wouldn't have said that at all. She said violinist. Sorry, classical violinist.
Well, how much music was in your house when you were growing up, and how much of it was country and bluegrass? And I don't want to use the word authentic because that's a very gray area, but you know, given the kind of music that you've been pursuing
right.
and the roots and the routes that you've been going down, how much of that was actually in your childhood?
I don't think we had more music than the average American or North American household. I do not think we did. And my parents didn't live for music in the way that I have or so many people of my generation have. It's one of the things we could talk about at length, how the people that are baby boomers and shortly before and shortly after, I feel demographically, music means a lot more to them than any other of the arts or to the generations before or the generations after. But I will say this, slightly contradicting what I've just said to you in the audience, David, is my dad took me to see a handful of country and western gigs as a kid, and I just didn't get it. I won't lie to you all, I didn't get it. And my mother was a square dancer, and I would go and they'd have the square dancing tunes, which are all very bluegrassy and up-tempo and all that, from the Scottish Highlands. And I didn't get it. And my father took me to, when the Grammys were here in 72 or 73, some native Nashvillean will know, I saw Harry Nilsson and Ringo Starr get out of a limo down there on Broadway. And I was so impressed by that. And my dad's like, who are those two boys with beards? And then later we went to some hideous place, which I think I was just a kid, and he had a beer while I didn't. And we went, and he said, we went to a record store, which is open at midnight, which is mind-boggling, a record store open at midnight. And the next thing I know, he said, just wait, son, just wait. Because my dad didn't buy any vinyl to speak of. Just wait, son, wait. So it's like, we're out really late, Pops. They moved all the fixtures to the walls, and five guys came in across the street like ducks in a row in matching suits, save the leader, who had a bit of a belly and was wearing opposite colors. Where he had white, they had blue, and where they had powder blue, he was wearing white. And they went in the store, and within 20 seconds of being at the far end of the store, they turned around and started walking the floor over you. And it was Ernest Tubb and his guys at his record store. And my dad's entire comment the whole night was, he got a slight tear in his eye. And I thought, what the heck? No electricity at all. They just played in his store after the Opry was over, right, on Saturday night. My dad had a tear in his eye. He looked at me and said, this man's music meant a lot to us in the war. And that's wow. all he said.
That actually says a lot.
A lot, yeah.
Now, you actually mentioned before we came on that you met Bill Monroe in 1974.
Yeah.
This sounds like a good time to tell that story.
In 1974, I had found a fellow Flying Burrito Brothers fanatic at the University of South Carolina who were beating Georgia 14-3 as I speak. And Steve Holland, he's now a professor at the University of Washington in economics, and he was a big Graham fan. We hit it off immediately and became very tight. And one day we were having one of these ridiculous debates record collectors have, like you and I are having backstage, batting it back and forth. And the idea was,
I don't find them so ridiculous.
Who in their genre of the arts has founded it and dominated it? Well, you can't say really Elvis, because he's not really the originator of rock and roll. And he kind of got usurped by the Beatles and people like that, as wonderful as Elvis was. So we're going on. I said, how about Louis Armstrong in jazz? And he said, that's close. And suddenly we came on the idea of Monroe in bluegrass. And yes, Flatt and Scruggs and the Stanleys are fantastic. But Monroe is really the template for bluegrass now, so much so that it's almost retarding the music. You wouldn't want the template for rock and roll to just be the Beatles of Beatlemania. But in a way, that's kind of what's happened to bluegrass. And so we went, we got to go see him. And in those pre-internet days, it was a bitch to try and figure out where somebody was playing if they weren't in your town. It was tough. And we finally figured out that in about 6 weeks, the Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys are going to be at Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, which is the same state. We drove 120 miles to the gig. And it was so un-rock and roll, it wasn't funny. It was as nice and informal as this. And when it was over, to my astonishment, and this is someone who had been seeing the Allman Brothers, Iggy and the Stooges, Loggins and Messina, the New Riders a couple times, another Allman Brothers, Neil Young on the Times Fade Away tour. To my astonishment, I was talking to the various people as the auditorium cleared out, and my friend Steve Holland said, turn around slowly. And I turned around, and right behind me, like I could grab them, were Kenny Baker and Bill Monroe. And they were just talking to people about, now what do you do to your apple pie? Now I'm serious. Exactly. Now, I didn't bring a pen. Now, what do you do to your apple pie? And the flake is, it's crusty on the flake? Because I got to write this down. And they're just talking to people. You know,
recipes. They're talking about recipes.
And when you went to see Iggy and the Stooges or Loggins and Messina, you didn't have Ron Ashton or Jim Messina after the show going, now, what kind of blueberries? Did you get them fresh? Because I got these frozen ones. And it just doesn't taste the same.
No. Well, you might ask Iggy about peanut butter, but that's different.
I missed that gig. People wanted to go. July 14th, 1970, Crosby Field.
I saw it on television.
I know. I was going to go and miss the gig.
Anyway, we digress.
Sorry. Do you all know what he's talking about, the peanut butter and Iggy? Okay.
It's on YouTube for all time.
And Stiv says,
anyway, finish Bill.
Real quick with Monroe. So anyway, Monroe's standing there, and he is not, with all respect to one of my heroes, he's not a warm, cuddly, friendly, in touch with his female side kind of guy. So the other guys in our party had extraordinarily long hair, as did I. So we knew that Monroe didn't like long hairs, which is why he wasn't on the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band's Volume 1 of Will the Circle Be Unbroken. We knew this. So I thought, we passed the hat. It was $50 to whoever had the nerve to speak to the great man. So I thought, I'll go first. And I thought, I'm going to win the $50. And what I did is I thought, I've got a second to do it. He's not going to like my appearance. I'm going to tap him on the shoulder. I'm going to make eye contact. I'm going to shake his hand firmly. So I'm going to tell him I'm from Kentucky. He'll like that. I'm going to tell him Dad likes his music. He'll like that. So I turned around. I tapped him on the shoulder. And he turned around and looked down at me like this. And I grabbed his hand, which he did not offer. I grabbed his hand and shook his hand and looked him in the eye and said, Bill Monroe, Mr. Monroe, I said, my name is Sid Griffin. My father told me if I ever saw you to shake your hand that you were a great man and a fellow Kentuckian. My dad's from people from Panther Creek, which is just up the road from where Monroe's people are from in Ohio County, Western Kentucky. And I just want to say, sir, I'm shaking his hand like a man. I'm gripping it. Just want to say, sir, it's an honor to meet you. And Monroe just looks at me, and he keeps shaking my hand. And he doesn't say anything, and he keeps shaking my hand. And I finished my spiel, and I let go, and he doesn't. And his grip is getting harder and harder and harder on my hand, David. And it's now starting to go like this, like a comedy handshake. And I can't let go. This is all true. And I can't let go. And my band, no one's laughing. It's like, and Kenny Baker's starting to giggle. And now Monroe's going like this with my hand. And he finally stops, still holding on my hand, looks me up and down and says, well, it's a pleasure to meet you, Sue. And Stephen Holland to this day says, hey, Sue, what's going on? These emails.
The next time I hear a boy named Sue, that story's going to come to mind. How, when you were listening to the Beatles, the Stones, the Buffalo Springfield, when you were growing up, could you, and Bob Dylan, could you hear any of the roots and branches of the music that was part of Kentucky, of your family growing up? Did you recognize any of that at the time?
That's a great question. I don't know that I did at the time, but shortly thereafter I did, because I was one of those people, I dare say like yourself and like many of the people here, that looked at songs on, let's say, a Rolling Stones or a Byrds album and saw that there were names in brackets, and I figured out that that meant who wrote the song. And I figured out that 2.2 with a colon 11 was the time of the song and all that. And then there'd be songs by the Stones or whatever that didn't have their names behind it.
Yeah.
So I would figure whoever J. McShann was, if he wrote Confessing the Blues, maybe he sang it. And I would go try and do
or
these
that
little
version of I'm Moving On, the live version.
There's Hank, the terrific version the Stones do. And I would think, well, maybe Hank Snow's worth checking out. So not immediately, but by 70 or 71, I was going backwards and putting two and two together.
Because it seems that a lot of the romanticism that's discussed, particularly in the kind of music that's played at a conference like this, people talk about the old weird America, the No Depression movement. In many ways, it's almost like a wished-for history. I remember talking to Jeff Tweedy about growing up in Illinois, and there was some country in his background, but a lot of what got him as a kid, you know, or as a teenager, was Husker Du. It was the Replacements. And Alison Krauss told me when I interviewed her around the time of Raising San that, you know, when she was winning fiddle contests, what she was really doing in between time was listening to Def Leppard and Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And not laughing about it. That was her soundtrack of her teenage years. And yet through that and through those experiences, you then come to something else, which isn't necessarily history. It's actually taking something historic and trying to make it your own.
Well,
part of your own future.
I early figured out that music or even art doesn't occur in a vacuum, that there's cultural and sociological reasons why people make things that they do. For instance, a lot of bands now are being stripped down because the economy's not there to have a bigger band. I mean, that's why the big bands died. It wasn't this, I keep hearing this thing about the big bands died, there's lack of popularity of them after the war, new sounds. Yes, but people couldn't afford to have the big bands in 47, 48, 49. It was just the expense was too great. And why do old records sound like that and all this stuff? Well, I mean, you know, we used to have the Fender, we had the Fender bass or synth bass, then the Fender bass, and before that you had the Doghouse bass, which Andrew and the Cole Porters we use, and before that you had the tuba. There's reasons why music sounds like it does and is what it is that are outside even you and I forming a band and wanting to do something. We're cognizant of that or not. And I clocked that earlier on. I loved history, so it was easy for me to sort of put these things together. I consider popular music history. I don't, in the way that most people don't, even those here, I consider pop music history. And when I hear Glenn Miller or whatever, you know, Robert Johnson, I listen to it, I know this sounds like Open University, but I listen to it as with sociological ears as much as
I do. Well, that's actually an interesting thing. If we go to the next picture, let's go to the next couple of pictures.
Look at that guy.
This is the shit, man, I'm telling you.
Do you all know who Sean Bonnywell is?
Yeah.
Talk. I actually saw The Unclaimed, and I believe actually it might have been after you left, because I think the Long Riders were on the bill, and this was at the Music Machine in L.A.
Yeah, we were.
And I actually remember talking to Shelley Gans at one point, because I did a story about the Garage Revival. The thing is that's interesting about that band is that this version of history is very much the dressing up. It's very much putting on the period in a very physical way. And I loved it, but it is a weird kind of purism. It's ultimately a dead end, which you got out of with the Riders. But what was it like being in The Unclaimed, and why did you was it a dead end for you?
Well, this is something the band and I were talking about at breakfast. And do you all know who Cyril Jordan of the Flaming Groovies is? Cyril and I have talked about this at length, David. He says you have a given popular music act, and they think their music's great, or it is great and it's popular. Well, that's half the package. The other half is how the band looks. And I remember doing a gig, and I know this is roundabout, but it's the metaphorical way I speak. We did, bless you, we did a gig in San Francisco, and at the end, we'd all learned about five or six songs. So there's members of the Groovies, the Long Riders, the 3 o'clock, and whoever else was on the bill. We formed this big Concert for Bangladesh band, and it got so out of hand and great that people were climbing on stage. And I'm not pushing anybody off stage, so it's there's now like 60 people on stage. And I remember climbing on stage to yell into the microphone, "Go, Johnny, go next to Chuck Berry." He didn't push me off stage, so I'm not pushing anybody off stage. So now it's so crowded. Cyril doesn't do that thing where you loop the guitar cable around the strap so yeah. If it comes out, it's still dangling there. He just plugs straight in. So Cyril, some kid's dancing and steps on Cyril's guitar, so now Cyril's unplugged, and he can hit the guitar as loud as he wants. No one's going to hear it. And Cyril stayed, and he saw it and went, eh, and stayed in this rock gutter and kept doing it. And after the set, I said, it was Street Fighting Man, and that was the final song of the night. I said, Cyril, at the beginning of Street Fighting Man, your cable came unplugged from your guitar. You were silent. And he said, and why didn't you stop and do something? Or you can't hear you. He said, half of rock and roll is visual, and I'm visual. And I thought, that's a great point. Yeah. And that's my roundabout way of answering your question. We're not the greatest
show the
band.
Next picture, because that's actually got it.
There you go.
But, you know, that really is the music machine.
And it's funny, someone gave me two shows on in those days, my friend Don Williams, not the country singer. I've got friends named Skip Ewing, Don Williams, and Gary Stewart. None of them are country singers, yet all three have an alter ego with that name that's had hits. Don Williams came in 1979, 1980 with something on his back which would crush him, and that was the portable camera of the day, and filmed two different gigs, of course. One is the Whiskey, and one's like the Club 88 of the Unclaimed. And I was really proud of the following. The band played really, really well. I played a psychedelic guitar. I don't mean the doodly Grateful Dead sense. I mean in the more concise Love sense, L-O-V, Arthur Lee.
The Johnny Eccles sense.
Yeah, Johnny Eccles sense, well said. And we looked great. However, the singing was uniformly horrible. I mean, Shelley, who was my, you know, I love Shell, the guy in the middle, but he was like a 300-pound Joey Ramone. He looked great, couldn't sing. And Barry and mine's backing vocals are like cats mating. I mean, it's just, it's horrible. At no time did anyone sit us down and go, you go, ah, and you go, ah, and you go, ah, and that's a harmony. It's just like, ah! And I was just, the instrumental passages, we looked great. I thought, wow, you could sell this. And then suddenly, the vocals come in, and I think, no, you can't sell that.
Well, how much of the Long Riders, and we can bring them up because they were actually a great garage-looking band, too. How much of the Long Riders was a garage band? Because I remember seeing you on that night and thinking, it's different, but it's not out of place.
Well, when we formed the Long Riders, it was just going to be another L.A. band, whether I want to admit that or not. And when the guy on the right came in, the good-looking guy in the picture with the Toreador's jacket, the Jackson Brown look-alike, he was from a country and western background and never liked playing Smash It Up by the Damned, which was an encore we did. Never liked playing Looking for Lewis and Clark, but would do that in order to let us do his thing, let him interject his Clarence White brilliant guitar licks. In fact, Hillman, we backed up Chris Hillman at some benefits, and Hillman told me and the band, he said, Stephen McCarthy is the only person ever I've heard play Clarence's lines right on songs like Have You Seen Her Face, which we did with Chris, that gets it right. And I've played with all sorts of top dogs. It's really down to Steven doing his thing. As I said at the panel yesterday with Exene and John Langford and Pete Case and all that, Warner, Steven should get a lot of credit for just the whole scene. I mean, he has a very quiet, I think a writer I know and love said Steve McCarthy's internal clock runs in reverse. I won't say who it was that wrote that, but... But Steven has a lot greater influence than I'm sure he recognizes right now. Yeah. And people like the Jayhawks, he was in the Jayhawks towards the last few years of their tenure. I mean, it was down to Steven. Steven just couldn't have that not come out in his thing. He's the guy that taught me to play country and western rhythm guitar and separate the one and the three and the two and the four, because I was just doing this punk strum. And it was that's what made the band, him coming in there. And it became this dynamic of punk rhythm section and punk energy with decent vocals for once. And country and western licks and guitar.
But was that a conscious decision?
No, it evolved.
Because if you listen to the 10-5-60 EP, you know, there are aspects of, there's that great scraping pedal steel effect in And She Rides. Yeah. But then by the time you're doing Native Sons, you are covering Mel Tillis, Mental Revenge, and you've got Gene Clark singing on Ivory Tower. So you're actually already blurring the, you're blurring the purism.
Yeah, and I think that, that
it became the Byrds version of country, as well as the Burritos and Mel Tillis. And
Ira Kaplan was a writer for Village Voice before he got the Yola Tango thing going, and he wrote a wonderful review of the Long Riders in at Maxwell's for the Village Voice in 1984, and he said people accused the Long Riders of being the Byrds and too much of a, you know, Xerox, a copycat, a photocopy, but actually it's like the Long Riders, it's like the Byrds albums 1 through 12 condensed into one act, one album. And I thought that was a wonderful thing, very astute thing to write. But it's really, it was really, really down to Stephen McCarthy, Tom's a brilliant bass player and Greg was a good drummer, and I was, you know, able to have some fire and be relatively interesting to look at on stage. But Stephen's playing and that big whiff of country and western. When we did Brand New Heartache, the Police and Boudreaux Bryant song written here in Nashville, or 6 Days in the Row, which I think were the first two country songs we did in the set, I promise you all, it was the first time LA punks that were not just fans of something like the Germs or the Adolescents were members of the Germs and the Adolescents. And I promise you, it's the first time they ever heard a live country and western song played by a band in their lives.
But what were you doing? Actually, you can roll some of these Riders pictures as we talk, because we're going to do this for a little bit.
This is, never mind. Go on.
What were the Riders doing that the Byrds and the Burritos did not?
Well, I think if you listen to particularly the Byrds, one of the reasons I'm obsessed with the Byrds is they don't ever rock out. Feel a whole lot better rock and roll, and the live version of So You Want to Be Rock and Roll stars rock and roll. But what I find fascinating about the Byrds is, in the immortal words of Fast Freddie Patterson, is the Byrds float.
Yeah.
The Byrds do not, they're not AC/DC or the Stones, and they don't want to be. They, at their best, they float in an ethereal
manner.
They're
like birds, they hover.
Like birds, they hover. They're like a, they're more of a helicopter than a rocket, and they hover, and they just, there's just something beautiful about the way that they exist in a sort of transcendental way. They do not want to rock out. They're not a leather jacket band. They don't have songs full of misogyny about women, and they don't sing about cars. I just found that absolutely fascinating.
Well, actually, so much of what they wrote had a lot to do with the way they sang, which was that effortless gleam. It was almost like, you know, creating a sort of oral version of light.
And, of course, the irony with all the Southern California bands, which are so brilliant with harmony, for instance, the Byrds and the Mamas and Papas and the Beach Boys, forward to the Bangles, who had terrific harmonies, as I could tell you firsthand because they'd rehearsed in the living room, is they all fought like cats and dogs off stage.
Yeah.
It's just the weirdest thing.
Dare I mention Buffalo Springfield.
Yeah, Springfield. All those harmony bands up to, shall I say it again, the Bangles, were the least harmonious people off stage you've ever heard or met in life. It's just one of life's great ironies. What was the other one? The Burritos. Well, the Burritos thing, it's the last time Hillman ever went for Ragged But Right. Chris Hillman since then has made some terrific records, but they have the polish and the professionalism on them. And with Graham in tow, it was Ragged But Right, and I really loved that.
Why do you think that the Riders really impacted initially in Britain? You know, you got Jake Riviera, his label Demon, picked up the 10-5-60 EP first before anybody, and then you got signed to Island Records by Chris Blackwell, which made you, at that point, bandmates with U2 and Frankie Goes to Hollywood, which I found really... counterintuitive, I don't know. But what was it that Britain got that America took either longer or never really nailed?
The problem is America's such a big country, it takes so long to break. The Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers did it just a few years before us. They became stars in England relatively quickly with the first album. It's on their DVD of that box set, or whatever it's called. I can't remember what the Petty box set's called. Anyway... And then they had some stardom in England, then they came back and were just dying when the Heartbreakers toured America. It was just really hard on them. And I
remember seeing them in a shopping mall once.
Yeah.
In 77. It was a club in a strip mall.
Pete Case was talking about seeing them at the Whiskey. I saw them at the Whiskey, and I think the opening act, it's a long time ago, but something like Blondie or something. It's incredible bills for like $3.50.
Actually, Petty told me that he did a bill. It was him and the Heartbreakers with Elvis Costello and the Attractions. It was $1 to get in, and they didn't sell out.
Yeah, sure. I don't know. I mean, this is name dropping, but when I lived with Eric Burden, the singer of the Animals, he told me. I said,
that's pretty good.
Yeah. He told me, well, he was in Southern California, not because he loved me, because he had bad asthma. So he would go to the desert, and he would come back to Hollywood to do his business, breathe the horrible air, and then have to go back to the desert. So the great Geordie told me that, I said, why was war, you took the guys out of war and based them in London? He says, because we were playing Ronnie Scott's, and I realized if we wowed them at Ronnie Scott's in London, it would happen a hell of a lot faster for us in England than it would if I took war and kept touring around the United States forever. So that, in the United States, in the defense of the long runner's humble career, we were huge in certain pockets, and then in other places we couldn't get arrested. But in Britain, where you have national radio, i.e. say the BBC, which is very important, once an Andy Kershaw or a John Peel is playing your record, you've not saturated the market, David, but you've touched the market,
Yeah. Which
is a huge... People are always asking me the differences between England and America. It's just, holy cow. And that is certainly one of them. If you've got something to offer that is unique and someone wants to make you known to the public, it can happen a hell of a lot faster than the UK, than the USA. We're just too big and too diffuse a country.
Give me a classic Riders road story, something that sums up what it was like, you know, both the hell and the heaven of being in that band in that particular period. There's got to, you know, something that just gives a sense of why that was such a special 5-6 years.
I'll tell you two, and I will be quick this time. Because WXRT in Chicago was playing our record, we sold out a 2,000-seater called, I think, the Metro. Anybody from the Windy City? And had one of the greatest nights of my life. Just on, people knew the song. You'd start da-da-da-da-da, and they'd get that applause. You start a song, play the first two bars, and people go, ah! The next night we played in Milwaukee, there were 75 people there. Going from 2,000 people to 75, and I mean 175, 75 was unbelievable. And there was such a crash. It's because in Milwaukee, they didn't have a hip radio station. Not that we weren't played on radio in Milwaukee, David. There was no hip radio in Milwaukee, other than, I think it was Marquette, had a student station that was, at the time, no offense, Marquette Warriors, pretty pokey. So that comes to mind, that 48 hours. But the one, just really quickly, the one story that sums the long hours for us, we played in Norway for the first ever gig, we played in the UK. Our first ever gig on the continent of Europe that's not to a British or audience is in Oslo, Norway. We play Oslo, Norway. And I don't know what goes on in Oslo, Norway after the gig. I mean, these people, I heard they invented sexuality. Would they have some kind of orgy or something? Where are we going? So the gig's over, and I don't know what the hell's going to go on. I don't know anything about Norway. I didn't know that it's like 5 English pounds, or i.e. about 9 American dollars for a beer. I didn't know any of this stuff. I didn't know anything. And they said, you're going to be interviewed by National Norwegian Radio. Our most famous DJ is coming in here. And I'm so excited. And then they said, his English is really, really good, so don't worry about it. So the guy comes in, and he's learned English from a Vietnam draft dodger who, you know, when you served in Vietnam, they had this crazy thing where they would give you 2 weeks R&R out of Nam, and you could literally be flown to, like, the French Riviera in place, and then you had to go back to Vietnam. And I'm not making this up. I had a cousin that served. And people would say, well, I want to go visit Uncle Hank. If you had served a distinction, you could say, I want to go visit Uncle Heinrich in Oslo, and they'd let you go. So some draft dodger, deserter from the U.S. military had taught this guy English, and the Riders are all excited to be interviewed. We've never been interviewed by anybody that wasn't an English-speaking person, because it's the States and the U.K., you got that? So this is the first time a non-English-speaking person is going to interview us, but it's okay because he learns English. He learned English from a Brooklynite who lived off Flatbush. So this guy comes in, looks at me, this total Viking blonde-haired guy, and says, hello, I'm, you know, Hans Finn, but I've got to take you to Long Riders. And I was talking to Jerry Lewis. And I don't want to laugh. You know, I thought, we're Americans. They hate Ronald Reagan. They're going to love me. They hate Ronald Reagan. We're going to show them the warmth and depth of America. I'm going
to
be a
and
sweet
guy. And you're talking
guy.
To the nutty professor,
yeah,
right?
And this guy could go on, what is it like to be the leader of the Paisley Underground? And anybody in the Long Riders will corroborate this story. And no, I had this thing where Dad would yell at me, and I'd bite my lip till it bled rather than laugh at him while he's yelling at me, because that would really piss him off. So I'm biting a hole in my lower lip, and I can taste blood coming in my mouth. But I'm not going to let this guy think we're ugly Americans and laugh at him. He was really talking like this. He it's, I know
that would
it
be surreal
like,
enough to scare me off music for life.
Yeah. It is. It's not an after dinner story. It's the gospel, and I just thought, and so, they're going to put this guy on the air, and then we're going to have people walking around Trondheim in the Arctic Circle. Going, hello, I've been learning English. It's true.
You just threw me off my game.
Howard Beach. There's the jacket.
Oh, well, that jacket. Well, that's interesting because one of the things that I felt about the Riders, particularly songs like Looking for Lewis and Clark, Final Wild Son, Harriet Tubman's Gonna Carry Me Home, there was a political and American history fabric current in the writing for that band. And I think it was actually much more contemporary and engaged than people thought because of the apparent influences. Was that something that was misunderstood about your band?
I don't know if it was misunderstood, but because we started going abroad so much, we became very aware that whether you want to be or not, when you all go abroad, I'm assuming most people here from the States, when you go abroad, whether you want to be or not, you are, as corny as this sounds, an ambassador for your country. So, and it goes in reverse. I mean, if someone from my gang from Britain or Carly from Canada is doing something here, people will remember you as that wise guy Brit or that wise guy Canadian if you don't behave. And so we were very, very aware of that, and it became reflected in the music because people abroad tend to know I don't know why, but people abroad tend to know the bad things about a country, and I don't just mean the States. It's very, unless they visited there, you mentioned like France or whatever, and someone will frequently say something horrible about one little thing that they may not know. So we had this battle to trying to convince people that everybody in the States wasn't. And I'm not saying, well, a lot of people we met thought everybody in the States was a right-wing bigot. And, you know, it really was painful to hear and deal with some of these people that didn't know us and some of the questions we'd be asked by journalists. And that became reflected in the lyrics.
One of the things, we talked about this on the phone the other week before we came down here, and it seems that it was kind of a Waterloo moment, was when the Riders agreed to do a commercial for Miller Beer. Now, this was in 1986.
Yeah.
When and how were you approached about doing this? The thing that actually struck me after we talked was that if so few people were buying your records here, what made Miller think you were going to sell any beer?
George Best. I don't know. We were approached by, they thought we'd appeal to this given demographic. The Long Riders got reviews you can't buy. I mean, front page, New York Times, Arts and Leisure sent section one Sunday. And you couldn't bribe anybody into giving those kind of reviews and that kind of press. So everyone seemed to know who we were, but no one seemed to really know why. We didn't get airplay. But that's something we could have brought up in the panel yesterday. There was nowhere to go back in those days. I mean, in a way, the Long Riders and the DBs and Jason and the Scorchers and the Bongos, Et Al, Green on Red, went as far as they could go because there were no avenues open to us.
You went as far as you could go on good reviews.
Yeah, and then the Hollywood joke is if good reviews sold CDs, Captain Beefheart would be a big star. And I've always thought that was a great one-liner because it's true. And there was nowhere else to go. And now, because of efforts of the Long Riders, Green on Red, DBs, Jason, et cetera, there is we kept the ball in play. We're a link in the chain. I'm not saying we were this great catapult that threw everything forward, but we were a link in the chain that kept things going for others to build on. And Chris Robinson of the Black Crows had a band called Mr. Crow's Garden. They opened for the Long Riders many, many times and were huge. And him and his brother in the Black Crows are very respectful and sweet to me to this nanosecond. Tweety was in a band and working in a record store in, I think, St. Louis, and they had a Black Flag type band and saw and heard the Long Riders that night that we did an in-store at his shop, and he became an acolyte. And it's just, we were just a link in the chain. But what I'm trying to say is we went as far as we could. Had there been someone who would have played this on the radio, people might have heard it and bought it, but there was nowhere to go. The people talk about college radio, and it was great, but college radio just went to this certain level, and there was a glass ceiling that went no further. You're talking to a guy who had two number one college radio records. Well, you know, it's like being the best batter in double-A baseball. That's fantastic. but it's not the Yankees
AA
and the Dodgers.
Baseball, yeah.
Yeah, it's not even AAA. And I'm not whining because we've had experiences that, I mean, everybody should be young and in a rock group and play gigs where people call your name. That's, I don't, you know, I feel blessed, but we went as far as we could.
But what was your reaction about being asked to do this? Because even if we take the financial situation aside for a minute, you have to deal with the issue of, is this something that actually goes with our ethics as a band?
Okay.
And the thing that's interesting is I looked at the ad again. I saw it. It's on YouTube,
is
like
it
everything.
Really?
It's on.
Check it out.
Yeah, it's actually part of a commercial block from WPIX-TV in New York from 1986. You will not fucking believe what people watched on TV in 1986. It is unbelievable. Actually, that ad is a beacon of light compared to what's in the rest of that commercial block.
I know there's at least 4 non-Americans here because they're my band. And what happened was the Longriders made a beer commercial. And
took
the corporate shilling, because they don't know this in Britain. So we took the corporate shilling, and I'd say within 2 weeks, it was saturated during the 1986 NCAA basketball finals. So to my British chums and my Canadian friend, what happened was is almost within 2 weeks, we became representatives of sort of corporate prostitutes because we did a beer commercial. Now,
it's interesting because the text of the ad, you're actually talking about integrity. Actually, Tom makes a comment about the integrity of the music, and Greg, at the end, makes a comment. I actually wrote it down. It was something to the effect of, where's my thing? Oh, it's just Greg says at the end, when you want to be the best in America, you have to mean it.
Yeah.
And in fact, that was entirely true of what you did as a band. The context was in the ad.
I don't know. I can tell you this. The reason we did the beer commercial isn't that anyone liked Miller beer or anything of that kind. What happened was the band were starting to get married and have children, and we didn't have any dough. So, of course, we needed money. So we did this beer commercial. It's the only real money I've made in the record industry.
And you actually said you've never received a royalty check from Universal.
I've never received a royalty check from Universal to this day. And there's various publishing things and radio plays that come in. And in Spain, the Longriders actually sold some records. But that in the corporate world, they can, what is the thing? It's called creative bookkeeping, but there's a more professional term of it.
It's the Sid Nathan School of Keeping Books.
Yeah, the Sid Nathan School of Keeping Books. They can play that off against a loss somewhere else in a different territory and say, well, the corporation up here doesn't owe you this money because in Canada you owe us this. So anyway, we needed money, so we did this commercial and became incredibly unpopular. And I didn't see that coming. I thought, we need money, we'll do the commercial. And like Dylan doing the Victoria's Secrets commercial, et cetera, today, the Dylan people know that Bob with his new record is not going to get a lot of airplay on contemporary radio. So they need to remind you that he's out there and has a new record out. So if he does some weird commercial, that gets Mr. Dylan's name out there. In the way that people know Coca-Cola is manufactured, but they still advertise it because they want you to know, hey, we're still out there. That's why they do Coke is the real thing. They know you know what it is. They just want to remind you they're out there. So we did this commercial, and it was other bands like X and the Blasters did commercials, but weren't crucified because they weren't popular commercials, so no one saw them. Our commercial hit a sweet tooth with the advertisers, and man, you could for about 2 weeks in America, you couldn't miss it if you watched particularly sports. And of course, to the non-rock and roll audience, David, people like my parents, they were really proud of that. Hey, the boy's on TV again, and so. It's really hard to explain to people outside the industry that, no, it looks like we've made a horrible mistake. I thought we'll get a paycheck. Great. And we'll get an announcement that we're a band and we have good sounds. Now check
that
us out.
That was an interesting thing about the ad, too, because at the very beginning, at the bottom, there's a script that says, The Longriders, Los Angeles, California. And when you think about how many celebrities now do ads without their name on it, they just sort of appear and people assume that they're famous, so I guess you recognize Beyonce because she's doing lip gloss or some shit. But you guys put your name right there where you were from. It was not treated as an embarrassment.
No, I didn't, but you have to remember you're talking to a guy who didn't think it would backfire. I didn't realize that I was the country rock Joe Strummer that I was. I know that sounds stupid, but really. And I really hurt a lot of people's feelings by doing a beer commercial who thought I was a sort of a Joseph Stalin Ford/Joe Strummer figure, and now look, he's taking the corporate shilling.
Do you think you took a bullet for all of the people that now discuss who want to be licensed, who want to be on CSI, who want to be on television.
In a way, I think it's beyond...
That's the kind of... kind of discussions that are going on this weekend.
In a way, it's beyond irony, because now we live in a world where Rod Stewart and the Rolling Stones go out on tour and they have corporate sponsorship. Does anyone really think the Stones and Rod the Mod need corporate sponsorship to get their message across for their tour? So... yes is the answer. In a way, we took a bullet. It's just the height of irony.
But even beyond the Stones, you have a situation where for artists trying to be heard, trying to be seen, you know, I get zillions of email publicity releases in which people extol the virtues of these artists by saying their music was used on, you know, CSI Miami.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit. I'm interested what can you do? And yet that has become not only a lifeline, but it's become it's almost like a badge of honor.
Yeah.
When in fact, what you did was get put up on a cross and then somebody threw burning oil on it.
Yeah, it was, if I had to do it again, that's the biggest career mistake we've ever made by far, or I've ever made by far, and I wouldn't have done it. But I mean, as you and I've discussed, Pete Seeger, when he was in the Weavers, did a commercial, for God's sake, Pete Seeger.
Now, Jefferson Airplane for Levi's.
Jefferson Airplane for Levi's, Yardbirds for Great Shakes. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, and I don't know. And the Del Fuegos took a bit of a bullet, too. I couldn't figure it out. I do remember, does anyone remember a band called Bonnie Hayes and the Wild Combo?
Sure.
Yeah.
Bonnie Hayes and the Wild Combo were wildly popular in San Francisco, and they played, to my mind's eye, if there's a member of the Bonnie Hayes band, could they take a bow now? Oh, good, because I'm going to badmouth them. They had an album cover. I was in sales at a major distributor then, and they had an album cover, which is them going, and there was confetti and balloons in the air behind them, and it was selling really well in San Francisco, and I just felt it was superficial, nothing against them personally, but I knew we'd hit rock bottom. It was one thing when Dave Marsh and C.M. Young are writing articles about Sid Griffin's, what a rat, we thought he was a great guy, and he sold out. I mean, that hurt, but when Bonnie Hayes and the Wild Combo had... were bad-mouthing me and the band in interviews, I thought, I've hit rock bottom. I mean, it's now going to be, I'd be walking through the Tenderloin District in San Francisco and a bum will get up and kick me and go, you bastard!
It's beyond cool.
Can you go any lower?
How much did it contribute to the writers ultimately breaking up?
I don't think any. I mean, you know, Blackwell thought it was a great idea. I mean, I adore Chris Blackwell. I mean, I was thrilled to be in the same room with him. He'd done so many great records and from Gimme Some Lovin' and to all the way from Spencer Davis, the reggae ska days up through Spencer Davis Group to Bob Marley. I adored being with him. And people have often said, did it kill the band or Island or whatever? And I mean, there were other villains in the Island Records chain, perhaps, but I adored Blackwell.
What was your life and feelings about making music after the Riders broke up? You hadn't moved to England yet.
Well,
I don't think.
I didn't understand. I didn't put on bad shows or anything, but I think what happened was I sort of lost the fire and lost the plot a bit, and I was sort of doing a Long Riders light. And I do hate saying that in a way, because there might be somebody here that knows some of the guys, and it wasn't them, it was just, you and I have discussed this before, don't do a weaker version of your greater days. Do something different. And I was doing sort of Long Riders LIT, and that was a mistake. And then, when I moved artistically forward from that, things got a lot better, and the clouds parted and the sun shone through. But in the immediate aftermath of the Long Riders, it was sort of a watered-down version of the same.
Because in a way, when the Cole Porters started, they were still primarily an electric band.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was funny. There were record label offers and all this stuff, and it was great for a while there. I mean, there was a more identifiable record industry as opposed to the one in transition they have today. That's one reason I formed the label, because there's the guys, the gang. That's one reason I formed the label, because I realized I could do it as well as some of these independent people. I know that's a horrible thing to say, and some of the bigger independents weren't better than the majors 20 years ago, so that's why I formed the label.
How has the Porters thing evolved for you? Because it's a very acoustic band, very bluegrass based, but you're also doing covers of Like a Hurricane, by Neil Young. You did an acoustic tribute to Chris Hillman. Obviously, a lot of the things that were very important to you, even in the Unclaimed and certainly in the Riders, are evident in what you do with the Porters, but it is a very different band.
Well, this is...
And a great band. Be there 10 o'clock tonight.
That's Dick Smith on the banjo, Carly Fry on the fiddle. That's myself looking more and more like my father every day in the middle. That's Andrew Stafford on the bass, and that's Neil on guitar, on the right, Neil Hurd on guitar. And I think I produced an album for a band called Lindisfarne, who don't mean much over here, but in the UK were pretty darn big. And I produced an album for them, and they were playing just acoustic music. They had a small drum kit on some of the set, but I just thought it was time to make a change and to do something new. And then I saw, also it was cemented for me when I saw End of the Century, the wonderful Ramones documentary, and Johnny Ramones started talking about, you know, when you hit your 40s, 40 to 45, and you're still playing electric rock and roll and lugging an amp around, it's not too dignified. And I wish he hadn't said it, because I went, ah! You know, it was a real epiphany, light in the road to Damascus, and I thought he's right. And the interesting thing about this wonderful band that I'm very, very proud of is that with this kind of music, it can grow and it can morph, and it's not stuck into this sort of post-adolescent band that so many people keep 4/4 rock and roll in. The other thing is, I notice in roots music, and this is a horrible thing to say, but I will say it out loud, in roots music, you can be pretty strange looking and no one cares. In pop music and most rock and roll, you have to be some conventionally form of either pretty, attractive, handsome, or hip. And in roots music, no one cares if you're skinny as a rake and look like you're on crack. No one cares if you weigh 400 pounds. No one cares if you're bald or if you have an unhip shirt on. In like real country and western.
Actually, you've just described
bluegrass.
Screaming trees.
Yeah. So I have. Real and
I like that band a lot.
Blues, you know, roots music, they don't care. The idea is one thing. Can you deliver? Do you deliver musically? Do you move us artistically? And I thought, that's for me. I really like that.
Are the Cole Porters truer to your Kentucky roots?
Has my act
roots?
Not changed? Look at that. Remember the rebel flag thing? It's the same thing.
It's a little Pete Townsend, actually.
Looks like Marty Stewart meets Pete Townsend. Look at their hair.
Are the Porters actually more true to your Kentucky roots if you were to sort of like trace the path?
Yes, but I don't almost want to say yes publicly, David, because it's sort of a...
too late. Yeah.
You got to remember that, and here's the difference between America and Britain. Although in Great Britain and France and throughout Europe, people are complaining about immigrants, they do not have, on percentage, the amount of immigrant influx that we've had in the States. It's four times what Britain's had per capita, ours is. And I don't want to lose all my friends here, but I'm not an anti-immigrant person, and I believe that one of the strengths of this country is the immigrant influx. Without the outside influence of other cultures, we wouldn't have the United States, or Canada, and Australia. Those kind of immigrant nations are super important.
Well, without your eighth generation grandfather, you'd still be in Scotland.
Yeah. And so the music that we play is indicative of that. And I've hurt some people's feelings sometimes in Kentucky when I've said, well, yes, it's Kentucky-ish music and all that, but if you take away the west of Ireland and the Scottish Highlands, you don't have a Cole Porters. So, and the great maritime fiddle tradition of the eastern provinces of Canada, you don't have a Cole Porter. Is that you, Carl? You don't have a Cole Porters. So the answer to your question is yes, but I have to put in that, what is the word, caveat? Caveat? How do you pronounce
caveat.
It?
Caveat.
Caveat. I have to throw that in as well.
Do you do any
shows?
Rider song? Yeah, well, not enough in America, actually.
Yeah, thanks.
How much Riders music do you incorporate into the Porters?
I've been trying to do at least one song at most of long Riders songs at a Cole Porter show so people can make the connection. And to this day, I still have people come up and put two and two together that I have a new band, that the long Riders don't exist, that I live in England to this day. And I try and mention the long Riders once, which I'm sure Dick, Carly, Neil, and Andrew don't want to hear. I have to mention sort of once on stage. I want to make that connection that, yes, it's me. And because we had a lot of wonderfully loyal friends and fans out there, and I want them to know I'm still out there making music, and I hope they'll give it a listen. I mean, this, to me, doesn't sound like the Long Riders at first listen, but if you listen to it, ladies and gentlemen, it has the same beating heart underneath the breastplate as the old band did, I promise you. It now has a somewhat Celtic/Cornwall/Canadian/Yorkshire tint to it, but it still has this same, you know, beating heart. And I'm always let down when people say things like, you don't have drums in your band. It's like, you know, we don't have drums in our band, but I promise you, we rock out. You have my word on that. The band rocks and kicks ass. It's a different kind of ass being kicked, but it's still ass kicking.
Now, you are also here as a celebrated author. Show your book again.
Yeah, man.
You know.
Which book,
don't
David?
Be shy.
I've written so many.
Oh, we'll start with that one, Shelter from the Storm. And you wrote the first biography of Graham Parsons, and I believe it was actually while you were still in the Riders.
I think I wrote that when I was in the Unclaimed going into the Riders. And it came out, and the publisher really kind of took a lot of things out of it. So it's mainly just the interviews and some essays, but I'm still proud of it.
Well,
Jim Lauderdale's got a copy.
But what got you started on that? Because that was actually, that was written at a period when many of his original records were out of print. This was pre the reissue boom
when
on CDs.
I think the one thing that may be on my CV when I die is he helped Emmylou repopularize Graham Parsons. And I'm sort of scared of that. I'd like to be known for something more than that. But it is true. When we first started doing interviews, the only things people would say, they knew Alex Chilton, they knew James Brown, and maybe, I don't know, Nick Drake or something. And I would say Graham Parsons. They'd ask, well, who do you like to listen to? Or whatever. I'd say Graham Parsons. They always thought it was Graham Parker. And I love Graham Parker in The Rumor. But no, it wasn't Graham Parker. We had to explain who it was. And I now feel like, you know, the Parsons family owes me a small check. Graham's, you know, the Graham reissue of GP with Grievous Angel?
Yeah.
Year in and year out for, was it Warner's? That's one of their top 20 CD reissues, even though it's ancient. And I think I had something to do with that, if you will.
Well, what did you learn about writing about music, about biography, criticism, language, approach to your subject in doing the Parsons book before you started doing liner notes, compilation stuff, and then ultimately the Dylan books? Because the Dylan books are very different from the Graham book.
Well, I learned I don't like asking people about their private lives. Unless it's germane to the issue, I don't ask about drinking, drugs, and stuff like that. Now, if someone has had 5 divorces, it's obviously been reflected in their songwriting at times, or it should be. You think that'd be enough subject matter? And I'll ask them, but I've realized I couldn't be a day-to-day journalist, and I certainly couldn't be some sort of... I couldn't write some of those harsh books like Albert Goldman's books about Lennon and all that, because I feel it's none of my business. Now, when it's germane to the issue at hand, I can ask, and I will, but that's something I've learned. And
but if you're choosing to write someone's life,
yeah,
then it's life in all of its glory and flaws.
And everybody's got a good side, and even some of the greatest musicians I've met and I've worshipped, I've seen, have had some bad sides. And unless it's something like they sell crack cocaine to small school children, other than things like that, I don't really slight them for it, because a lot of people have thrown away a good marriage, and a lot of people have spent the family money, and a lot of people have drank and drugged. I mean, if I was interviewing Scott Fitzgerald, I would have to ask him and Zelda about the drinking. But had it not been reflected in his career and in his art, I would have never brought it up. So that's something I've learned.
Why did you choose to focus? Oh, the other book. Let's hold the other one.
Yeah,
Million Dollar Bash, which is a fantastic dissection of one of the great lost weekends in rock of band and Dylan during that summer and fall of '67.
Yeah.
Recording up in Woodstock, track by track. I can't believe actually some of that stuff you listened to.
Well, I can't believe that you all realize I'm age 54.
Some of those tracks are pretty.
And you realize this is 1967. So how old is a 54-year-old in 1967? Now look at Dylan's shirt. This is actually a 66 photograph, I think. I have actually had 24 people ask me, is that you next to Dylan? What, are you kidding me?
Yeah, you look a lot like Richard Manuel. Yeah.
I mean, are you kidding me?
But why did you focus on those two eras, the Basement Tapes and then Rolling Thunder?
Well, we're at a point in pop culture today in society where people have, it's now you can buy a book on almost any aspect of the Beatles' career. When I was a kid, the Hunter Davis book came out, and you read the Hunter Davis book and you learned about the Beatles, and that was that. Now, individual aspects, I'm using the Beatles as just an example, of the Beatles' career is being sliced and diced, as is Elvis Presley and Dylan and so on and so forth. And they gave me the publisher. I signed the 3-book deal, and the publisher said, what can you write about? And I thought, well, you get a list, and there's like Christianity and the Nazis, and all. Oh, my God.
I didn't see that documentary on the History Channel.
Yeah, I mean, and so I thought Dylan, and now you don't write, if you write a big book about Dylan, say 500 pager of his whole career, that'll be like the 12th or the 15th that's on the bookshelf. So now you write about just that one aspect of his career. Million Dollar Bash is about the Basement Tapes. Up There with Smile is arguably the greatest rock and roll album that never was. And then I moved on to Shelter from the Storm because I think his Rolling Thunder Review era was another underrated era of Dylan's career. And the next one's on the so-called Jesus Years, which people seem to hate, but there was some really wonderful music made there. And it was as much a drama, him turning to Jesus, as it was turning to electricity in 65.
So just hypothetically, what is your argument for the Jesus Years? Just as a prelude to an advance warning.
I think everyone here knows the Pop Festival in 65, Newport Folk Festival, he played electric. Well, you know, 1913, when Stravinsky did Rite of Spring, there was a riot going on while they were performing. People were so outraged at his sense of harmony that he was using in the... And that's what a guy like Stravinsky does. It's tough luck audience. This is where I'm going. And on the side, talk about the drama of some of the Dylan shows with the electric band in 65, or the drama of Dylan with the Jesus Years, Stravinsky had several guys on the side counting, clapping and counting out the beat to people in the orchestra because the boos were getting so loud at the performance that the musicians were losing their way. But this is what a real artist does, like Dylan. Dylan, to me, is an iconic figure. He's not just a great songwriter. Look at him like a painter. And the way Picasso has 5 eras of painting. Picasso has a blue period and a cubist period. Dylan has a Rolling Thunder View period. Well, Dylan's had a Jesus period. And the fact that those songs came out and had the word Jesus and Lord in them is no less, should not demean them in your eyes, perhaps a non-Christian's infidel eyes, as art. I mean, he put his head in the chopping block, and I deeply admire him for him. Also, if you'll turn off your ears to the lyrical content, some of those songs just totally rock and kick ass.
Having gone through all of those Rolling Thunder, you actually do some literally note-by-note examinations of shows and the records, and also you do a scene-by-scene dissection of Rinaldo and Clara, which I found really interesting but also hard to get through, much like the movie. Yeah.
No, everyone says that's pointed out.
It's actually very helpful by telling me when I should like go out for popcorn.
What I wanted, I went through Rinaldo and Clara scene by scene, is because I want Jeff Rosen to allow me to re-edit it. That's Dylan's manager. And Jeff Rosen's a film fanatic, and he doesn't think Rinaldo, he literally told me, David, I said, why don't you guys put out Rinaldo and Clara as part of this bootleg series? Or, you know, and he says, yeah, so you and the 6 or 7 other people that want to see it, Sid, can see it again. And I feel, like many a film, that within the cans that are marked Rinaldo and Clara, as in many films, there's a great film waiting to be seen.
Do you actually see examples of what would be his Jesus Years in any of this?
Can you
see the clues of a movement to that?
Clearly what you see when Dylan's I had to, about his marriage breaking up in the Rolling Thunder Years, because it's reflected in so many of the lyrics. I write about the breakup of his marriage a bit, and clearly, when his marriage broke up, and I mean, this, you could say, well, how do you know this, Sid? You can't prove this in a court of law, but it affected him deeply and beyond an emotional way, in a professional career way it affected him, and it affected him and I will use the word spiritual way. It rocked him to the core to lose such a fantastic woman, and he said the mortal words, nobody in my family gets divorced, nobody, and I got divorced. To use a Britishism that I quite like a great deal, Dylan felt by getting divorced, he let the side down. I love that phrase. And I think he turned to, what the hell is my life about? I mean, I've lost this fantastic woman. My family's being ripped asunder. What is my life about? And he felt a hollowness. And on the Rolling Thunder Review, which I will bring up in my next book, on the Rolling Thunder Review tour was already Stephen Soles, S-O-L-E-S, who is the first one of these guys, no, T-Bone, who were born again. Yeah.
Because the Alpha Band, T-Bone, yes, Stephen, and David and Mansfield, David, was very much a Christian band.
The Souls and T-Bone got Mansfield into Christianity, as they eventually, McGuinn, T-Bone and them say, as McGuinn said, he then was affected by it, and they all got the bug. And it's from, the, I think, some of the excesses and some of the emotional roller coaster of the Rolling Thunder Tour. They found, okay, we're rock stars and we can do these narcotics and people love us, but at the end of the day, why are we unhappy? And I think that was the turning to Christianity. And I think Christianity is that generation's version of rehab. Because you notice a lot of them, well, Gwen still is and T-Bone is, but a lot of them aren't anymore. I won't name names, but a lot of these people did turn to Christianity. And once it cleaned up their lives and everything was okay, it was like, okay, thanks God, nice knowing you. And they went on about their business.
Well, that also gives the title of Desire an interesting sort of double-edged quality.
And you look at a song like Oh Sister on Desire, and if you make it a capital He in the word H-E, it could be about God. I mean, Dylan always had theology in his songs. He, as early as Free Will, he's got biblical references and biblical metaphors. And, of course, at his house, he had a big, a huge Bible on a stand, kind of like that, but, you know, a pedestal stand. And it was open to anyone who would go through pages and all this stuff. And I have a dear friend whose name won't be announced into this microphone who did the same thing. He turned to Christianity, got this huge Bible on a pedestal in his living room, and cleaned his act up, and later just became he left that particular world and is now a non-drink, non-drugs guy, but he's not quite the God-botherer that he was. He used Christianity and Christ as rehab, which I'm not advocating or bad-mouthing. I'm just saying people do.
How would you describe the state of your life in music? You've been through a band with a major record deal. You run your own label now. You write books. You have the Cole Porters. It's in a way what you've created is a life in music, but a lot of it has to do with, you know, the day-to-day labor of getting paid, getting things out. It's as much about being a worker as it is being a player. No, and it gets to what Johnny Ramone's thing was about the Ramones, which is like, hey, it's like a gig in construction. You know, I show up for work, I do the job, I get paid, you buy the T-shirt, I go home.
Well, I always wanted to be like the king bee or the queen bee, and I've become a worker bee. But I really don't mind that. At first, you can laugh at this if you'd like. I had about a six-month period there where I thought I was going to be like a Joe Strummer or Paul Weller spokesperson for his generation back around 84, 85. And then I realized that wasn't going to happen. And I also...
Why? What was the moment that you realized it?
Well, even before the band broke up, I just realized it wasn't in the cards. It wasn't in the cards. And I don't know.
Was that disappointing?
In a way, but I mean, as one is in front of a notable audience talking about himself, I mean, this is great. I mean, this is like, you know, the best therapy I could have. I'm thrilled to be here. And I just think that, this is going to come out really corny. I think it's time to sort of count your blessings. I mean, a lot of people have a lot worse off than I do. And I remember when my mom died, Stephen Gatos, and my dear friend at Variety, his mother had passed away a few years earlier, and he sent me this just terrific email. He said, what do you do now? He said, here's what you do. And in big capital letters, he wrote, you be grateful. And be grateful because you had good parents, and a lot of people don't have the one good parent. You had two. So that's the way I look at my career. I mean, I'm grateful. And the fact that this wonderful band, this wonderful record that I'm so proud of, is arguably the best record I've ever made. Everyone says it's the best record since The Long Rise. Well, I feel it's arguably the best one. I'm so proud and happy and fortunate to have a second bite of the cherry with this mob, doing a different kind of music perhaps, but it's the same beating heart underneath the breastplate, that I just look on the positive side. I mean, most people grow up and they're fans of so-and-so. Well, I grew up, I was fans of a wonderful band called The Birds, and I was friends with I still am friends with the three remaining guys, and that's the kind of thing that's my payment. I get to be in the Cole Porters and play wonderful music with wonderful people, and every once in a while I get to take a phone call from Chris Hillman, and I have a slight shaking for the first few moments of that phone call. I mean, most people that grow up that love Pele or George Best or Willie Mays don't get a phone call from them. And so that's sort of my payment. Last night I got a little payment. This guy my age came up to me and said, I saw you at the Metro in 84. You just guys levitated the place. You took the roof off the place and blah, 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 blah. I mean, a nice chat for 5 minutes. And, of course, It's the same. I do the same thing, David, that I used to do in high school. When a cute girl would notice me or say something to me, I'd be like dying on the inside. I'd be so happy and shake. But I'd be like, yeah, well, you know, maybe I can help you with the algebra homework. Sure. So I did it with that guy last night. I was thrilled. Some guy was making a fuss of me and introducing his wife to me. And he brought a friend over who had been to the show. But on the inside, I'm just going, yeah, the Metro. I remember that gig, man. Yeah, it's great.
Well, the thing is, you survived, and you survived with dignity.
To live again. Yeah, to live again. T-Bone, what did T-Bone say to John Cougar Mellencamp? You were a big rock star in the 80s. Now how are you going to finish your career with some dignity?
I guess that's the big problem, how you do this with dignity in a business that doesn't necessarily reward it or, you know, has other priorities.
No, and I you know, it is hard because there is an adolescent, fun-filled side to what I want to bring to when the band, that band, the Cole Porters, play on stage, because I know it has a warmth and a heart that people enjoy and sort of expect from me. But you don't want to take it too far and be one of these acts. Lester Bangs wrote a great thing about a band. I can't mention their name. It's cruel. But he wrote, I'm paraphrasing, but you'll remember the article. Lester wrote, why doesn't this band change its name to Send Money? Everything about them, the way they've been put together by a corporation, the way there's nothing organic and the way they met each other and decided they'd make this kind of music, the way they've gotten attorneys, the way they've got the sexy babe out front, the way this is that, why don't they just change the name to Send Money? Why should any of us in the rock and roll hierarchy, those that are getting free records like myself, or those people that are reading this copy that I'm typing in a manual typewriter now that are working as plumbers, or is working as assistant paralegals at some law firm, why should we send these people money? And I don't ever want to be in a band that you all would think is called Send Money, ever.
It's never happened. It never will. Sid Griffin.
Thanks, David.
Shout it from the storm. Come on, shout it one more time. He's going to be signing books. Cole
up
Porters.
There somewhere.
Please. Cole Porters tonight at 10 p.m. at the station.
Please come up and say hi. At the,
and we're just going to walk you off the floor with my favorite Long Rider song. Hit play.
Hey! You all realize Castro heard this song, right?